You're listening to On Margins. I'm Craig Maad, and this is episode 10. Today, I'm talking with John Gray. Although, if you're in the book world, you know him by his design moniker, Gray 318. John has designed covers for William Gibson, Zadie Smith, Salman Rushdie, David Foster Wallace, Robin Sloan, and perhaps most famously, for Jonathan Safran Foer.
Well, that's the thing about books, isn't it? It's such a basic sort of thing. You can't quite believe it. I think that's probably why I still sort of fit in this world, because I'm pretty basic too. My work is pretty basic. The process is quite basic.
Remember when Jonathan Safran Foer's Everything is Illuminated came out, and it had that gorgeous, messy, handwritten letters on the front, and then everyone and their uncle was making books with that kind of lettering? That's John's doing. John's been at this for a long, long time. And as you can hear in this interview, John is just a straight-up lovely human being, kind and self-effacing and warm, and despite having designed some of the most recognizable and successful covers in the world, humble. He's a humble dude. I had the pleasure of visiting Gray 318 in his studio in London, or rather, his old studio, since he just moved a couple days after we recorded this. Together, we opened his boxes of books and pulled out some of his best covers to get the stories behind them. You may be thinking, Craig, isn't it boring to listen to two dudes blabber about book covers when I can't see them? And yes, it is boring. Which is why if you're listening to this podcast in Overcast, you'll see what we're talking about appear as the cover art for each chapter of the conversation. So I highly recommend you use a podcast player like Overcast that supports inline cover art changes. Also, the full transcript for this episode with a bunch of photos is online at craigmaad.com/onmargins. Now, unfortunately, I have to issue a trigger warning for this episode. I do use the phrase wabi-sabi in a non-ironic fashion. I know. Really? Wabi-sabi? Really? Yeah. I just wanted to make sure you were prepared for that. It even felt like a little bit of violence against myself as I said it. So even considering that, I hope you enjoy today's episode.
Hello, John.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm good. Yeah, how are you?
I'm all right. So, where are we right now?
We're in a sort of spare room of my studio in De Beauvoir, which is East London. It was an old dog biscuit factory ago, and it got converted. Yeah, oh, well, obviously, it's not still a dog biscuit factory. It got converted into artist space.
Nice. How long have you been in this building?
8 years. So, but everyone else has been here a lot longer. So 10, 15. So
you've been here for 8 years.
Yeah.
In this studio. And before this, were you working out of your house?
Before that, I had a studio in my garden that I built.
Yeah.
I was there for 2 years before I finally sort of went completely mad and ended up having to leave. It just drove me insane being on my own. So I felt like, do you remember David Blaine? What happened to David Blaine? The guy who used to kind of...
The magician?
Yes, exactly. And is he still around?
I think so. He eats glass now.
Oh, does he? Yeah. Oh, no, so at least he didn't come to that. No, but he used to do this thing where he was like suspended in a glass box. This stunt in London. He was suspended in a glass box for, like, I don't know, 20 days. And I felt like that in my studio. It just felt like I was literally nose against the glass by the end of it, saying, please let me out. So
I had this image that you were still in that garden studio.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. No, I mean, it's still got, you know, I've got all my stuff in there. It's like a time capsule, but I moved back in here.
But this is, so this is 8 years, garden studio is 2.
Yeah.
It's only 10.
Yeah.
But you've been doing book stuff for like 20.
Yeah. So before that, I had a studio, another studio further east with Jamie Keenan, another book designer, and another couple of other designers. We had another sort of similar old space. So, yeah, nice. That came to an end. And, yeah, before that, Random House. Yeah.
Oh, you were in-house?
In Random House, yeah, with Jamie.
And here in London?
Yes. Yeah, which is their offices down in on the Thames, basically. Yeah, you don't need to know where their office is. Yeah.
Well, this place seems great. I mean,
yeah, it's really good. I mean, some amazing sort of artists in here as well. Sort of, I don't know, Tom Gould, Marion Duchat. Other book designers, illustrators, photographers. It's great. It's a really nice sort of shared space. Yeah, yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
But it's coming to an end, sadly. Yeah. We're all going our separate ways. But
the building is finishing.
Yes, they're doing. I don't know if you can see, but they're starting to sort of gentrify all these other buildings.
Mm. And
they're doing the same to this one, unfortunately. This is what happens in Fort Greene.
It's true.
Yeah,
that's funny. Yeah. I think that's exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
So they're kicking you out, or it's just the rent is
the lease has come. The lease has come to an end, and we can renew for double the money, which is none of us can afford.
So, right.
So I'm moving further into Hackney, so further out east.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad I got to see
the final days.
The final days of this.
Literally,
place.
We leave on Monday. So,
oh
yeah.
No. Oh yeah. Wow. Well, so we have a couple boxes.
Yep.
Of books.
Yeah.
Shall we look through these boxes?
If we have to. Yeah.
Okay. So I think this works. We can just kind of hang out on the floor.
Yep.
It's like being in Japan.
Yeah.
So we're kind of sprawled out on this old hardwood floor that was once covered in dog biscuits.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
we're
exactly.
We're gonna cover it in books. So let's see. What do we got going on in here?
Okay. Right. So that's Allen Ginsberg.
Yeah.
That's one of do you know what? I can't remember what the English title is. That's how bad I am. Can you read Italian?
No.
Okay, so anyway, that's a series. I did like a series of Allen Ginsberg books for a publisher in Italy, and I had this idea of, I think there's this thing with poetry books, I never know what to put on the front quite. Yeah. It's because they want something that's abstract, and I don't know, I had no ideas for that at all. So I decided instead I would put a whole poem on the front of each book, done in a different script, done in a different font, which sounded like a sort of interesting idea when I started, but of course I don't read Italian or speak Italian, so I had hundreds of spelling mistakes and errors and had to redraw over and over again. So it was actually quite a frustrating idea.
Well,
but it was a nice series.
Well, it's interesting too, because all the poems are in English. It's not... Or are they? Oh, there. It's
no. I think there's a mix.
I see. Well, yeah. I think it's a 1-to-1. The facing pages are Italian.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
right.
That's smart.
I should have looked inside. Yeah.
How much reading do you do before? It depends on the book.
Yeah.
Some books you do. Do you like?
No,
you,
most of them I try. Most of them I really try to read. I don't, obviously, for obvious reasons. If I'm working for a foreign publisher, I tend not to, unless they can provide me with the English text.
Right.
They could have done in this case, and I probably, but I, you know, I've read lots of things. It kind of didn't matter, because I didn't want the book to be summed up by one particular poem anyway. I wanted it to fit, you know, have a whole, the feel of his poems rather than a poem. So.
And also, you were thinking of it in terms of series.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. So there were five of those.
But like, what about, I mean, you did Infinite Jest, Pale King.
Yeah.
Did you make it through those?
I've tried three times to read Infinite Jest and still failed. I've got a little bit further each time, which I feel is, you know, maybe one day in my retirement I'll get through the whole thing.
Yeah.
But no, I have to confess, no. Have you?
No. I haven't even tried.
Okay.
I love his essays.
Yeah, me too.
And I feel like that's about all I have the stamina for. I feel like it's like running a marathon. You know, Infinite Jest.
It's a huge dedication, isn't it, of time. And I know that's an awful thing to say.
Yeah. Well, it's Gravity's Rainbow kind of falls in the same category for me. Have you done it?
Tried it.
I haven't designed it.
I've tried to read it. And.
I have. I've been carrying Gravity's Rainbow around with me for 20 years now.
Yeah.
I bought it in high school. Yeah. And it's just come with me everywhere. As this, like, in this, I don't know, this man, like, this physical manifestation of, like, who I want to be a person who can read Gravity's Rainbow.
Yeah. It's also this like, fantasy of time, isn't it? It's having this chunk of time where you're going to... Often these books I sort of categorise in my head as like for retirement or something, or holiday. It's always like, oh, when I'm on vacation, yeah, I'll take Ulysses and I'll read the whole thing. And it never happens.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, I also feel like those are kinds of books that benefit from university.
Yeah.
So, like, having a professor there talking you through it.
It's so true.
There's a density that attacking on your own is kind of hopeless.
Definitely.
So we have so many books in here. So how many have you done in total? Like 18,000 books?
Do you know what? I've got no idea how many books I've done. I think since I've been freelance, I'm on to my 350th invoice.
Okay.
So if you think of that, then some of those invoices will be for multiple covers. So do I mean 300? Do I mean 3,000?
I would think 3,000. I mean, you've been freelance.
Yeah, it can't be 200. What am I talking about? Sorry, that's lunacy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cut that bit.
3,000-ish.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have a couple things here that just popped out.
Yeah.
Kiss Kiss.
Okay. Yeah, so this is for Penguin. This is the Roald Dahl backlist, which was, I probably did 3 or 4 years ago, maybe 5 now. What an amazing job, what an amazing writer. So yeah, it's just this, the whole backlist, and I just had this, I set this little brief for myself, which was each cover would be made up of two photographs kind of sandwiched together in a weird juxtaposition. So in this case, this is Kiss Kiss, so I've got wasps coming out of her mouth kind of thing.
But very different style than a lot of the other, like,
yeah,
this.
I'm quite conscious, or have been at times, that I don't want to get pigeonholed as being one particular kind of designer or one, you know, the go-to guy for hand lettering was, for a while there, that's what people came to me for. They wanted some kind of hand-drawn font. And I just got to the stage where I thought, this is not where I want to be. I don't want to be considered someone who solves problems the same way every time. So I made a conscious shift away from that, and you know, yes, I do that stuff still, obviously, because it sometimes, if it fits a brief and it's if it answers a problem, then I'll use it. But other times I will, you know, do a purely graphic response, or I'll use existing fonts and I'll use photography. It's whatever kind of fits, really.
And so here we have
this
is interesting. This is a Foer book.
Yeah,
Jonathan Safran Foer, but it's the Visual Editions book of his that I forgot he even made. I forgot that he did this book, Tree of Codes. Was this the first book that Visual Editions did?
No, second okay. I think. Yeah.
I remember being pretty shocked that they had pulled him in.
Yeah, no,
like,
completely.
That's a big get, right?
But I think it was, he had this idea for a book, and I think no other publisher would touch it. It was too much. It was too big for them to handle in terms of print, because he wanted to take the original. God, what's the book called? Street of Crocodiles.
Street of Crocodiles.
The book Street of Crocodiles. He wanted to take that novel and then to cut it out, cut pieces out from the text, and form a new text, which was his book Tree of Codes. And I think every other publisher just looked at that idea and completely balked. So apart from Visual Editions, who saw it as a sort of total gem of a challenge and did it, yeah.
And so, I mean, this book's, it's crazy. You open it up.
Yeah, they're completely crazy. Yeah,
and this is completely chopped up. And this is we're looking at, this is a dummy that, were you involved with the innards as well? Here?
No, what happened is that Sarah DeBont Studios did the entire insides and the cover.
Okay.
But then I think for some reason, either Jonathan or Visual Editions weren't convinced that the cover was how they wanted to sell him or how he wanted to be seen. So they asked me to have a go and then ended up liking what I'd done and going with it. So I've actually always felt slightly guilty about it because I feel like it should have been Sarah DeBont Studios who did the cover because they did the insides, and it should have been their whole package. So,
What did it end up as? Because this is the dummy.
Do you know what? I'm not even sure there's a copy in here. I think maybe all my copies at home. It just ended up as a series of dots, basically. It's a series very small dots painted, and then just a bit of text that I've used an old typewriter or something. I can't quite remember what I did. I scanned some old books. That's it, all different old books, and had this sort of old text running through these dots. So I don't know. Perhaps you can find an image to...
Because, I mean, it's completely...
It's a crazy book.
I don't even know how to read this. It's just, you know, it's all these die cuts.
I think that was the original before they'd got to the text actually making shape. I think Visual Dummy 2, you can start to read, I think.
Yeah, I think. A little bit.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. It's not easy.
Everyone wore his children.
Jeez. It's very interesting. It reminds me of Daniel Lusky's Only Revolutions. Remember that? Do you know that one?
No, I don't.
Do you know he did House of Leaves?
Oh, yeah.
You know that book?
Yes,
yeah?
I do.
So he's only really done two books, I think, as far as I know. He did House of Leaves, and that was kind of like a cult super hit.
Yeah.
This is 20 years ago.
I think what the cover for that is that... No, I can't remember.
I can't remember either. Yeah. But it was terrifying, that book. I don't know if you remember.
No, I never read it.
Oh, yeah. I read it. I remember it was very... Yeah, I mean, it really stuck in the mind. I mean, it's about this house that... They keep measuring it, and the inside and outside measurements don't match up. Right. And it's, like, expanding. And they can't tell why, and then there's this other backstory. But the second, his follow-up book to that, Only Revolutions, was equally kind of weirdly incomprehensible in some ways. And you had to read the book. You had to keep flipping the book over. It was two stories that were coming together in the middle of the book and then going on. Anyway, lots of...
Mind-blowing.
Lots of difficult design stuff going on there, but so we got all right. Look at this book. All right, this box. So we got the Zadie Smith stuff.
Yeah.
Swing Time. So what's going on here? I feel like N.W. Zadie Smith N.W. I feel like the Swing Time font somehow like almost came to be like branding.
I don't know whether we've done that with any of the other Zadie Smith, but yeah, it was very much like, we'll just use that font. I mean, I just took another font and I've kind of messed around with it, added some sort of deco touches to it. And they did bags and T-shirts and all sorts. Yeah. So it did,
Well, I mean, it's an interesting thread, right? It's like, the only visual component of a book, I mean, I think I was reading an interview and you described the book cover as like a travel poster to like this place, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's a great description of it, right? I mean, it's the thing that like either pulls you in or doesn't pull you in, right? I mean, you can read all the reviews or whatever, and then when you pick it up,
yeah,
it's also the thing that kind of maps onto your mind as the, you know, the visual imprint, the stamp of what the book is.
Exactly. Yeah, it's the front door, basically. So, you know, it's an invitation, isn't it, into another space, I suppose. So,
but it's also, I mean, to be kind of crass and markety, it's also the main point of branding.
Yeah.
And you can kind of define an author's feel through that.
Yeah, I think that's why probably recently a lot of covers feel like they're getting simpler and simpler, because it's becoming almost like a logo, because it has to work at like a logo at different scales. Mm-hmm. And so you've got clearly like online, you've got billboard, you've got the book itself. So I do feel like there is this sort of simplification in a lot of instances, which is good, but then you need, you know, as after a while, then that becomes like, oh, well, we need something new. We need to attract something another way. We do, you know, we need to not just use these kind of like logo types.
Yeah.
But I feel that started almost that kind of started for me with like, when I did Everything Is Illuminated, yeah. I feel like that was the first kind of type as image it was a branding almost in itself. I hate using the word branding, by the way. Sorry.
It's crass, right? Because the whole point of literature is to sort of like be above that, right? To not be thinking about, you know, I'm sure Jonathan was not thinking about how to market this book when he was writing it.
No.
You know?
Not.
And so then when you start applying those words to it, it feels like you're dirtying it a little, maybe.
Yeah.
But I don't know. But I think that, there's something tremendously valuable about having a visual theme kind of running through an author's collection of work.
Definitely.
Yeah. Right? I mean, it's sort of...
Definitely. Yeah, I agree.
It sort of pulls it together. I mean, brand has all this negative connotation to it, but...
Can we find another word
for it? What is it? Like a crest? It's like the family, the author's family crest. We got these three Saffron Four books here. Everything's Illuminated, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, and then Here I Am. And yeah, they definitely, I mean, there's a thread between all these, right?
Yeah, well, I hope so. Yeah. What is it, though? What is the thread? I think that's the interesting thing, isn't it? I mean... It's the handcrafted element, I guess, I don't know. There's a crudeness, I suppose. I suppose that even with Here I Am, I've drawn this font and I've deliberately made it ugly. You know, there's a deliberate attempt to make proportions slightly wrong. You know, there's an extra thick O in fur.
Yeah.
I don't know, the eye is too wide. It's deliberately made to look handmade, almost.
And, yeah, I mean, what
but it's interesting,
what's compelling about that?
Well, I don't know. A lot of people say to me, oh, I can tell it's one of your covers. And I think, oh, I wonder what that is then. I wonder why you can tell it's my cover, even though it's because they're not intrinsically the same, are they? Do you know what I mean? This one's got a... big block sans serif font. This has got a hand-drawn kind of script. This has got a serif, and yet somehow there is some sort of...
Everything is illuminated and extremely loud. I mean, there's this kind of density, this kind of bursting, right, that's happening.
Yeah.
You know, the type is like, is trying to get out of the container.
That's true.
And Here I Am kind of falls outside of that.
Maybe it's the background is because the text, which is, I know I'll show you some of the paintings in the studio, but this background is basically a 6-foot painting of a chunk of text that Jonathan's given me from the first chapter, I think. So,
and you painted that out?
Yeah, I painted that by hand. Yeah. So that's a big sort of 6-foot by 3-foot kind of board with text painted on, which I then went on to do the Polish version and the Dutch version. So
in the same way?
Yeah.
So painting in Polish.
Hand-painted, yeah.
Why do it so big? Why 3-foot by 6-foot?
That's
the only way to fit it all?
I think because we wanted to wrap the whole thing right around the cover, and I tried to make it small, and it just started to smudge and blur, and it just didn't feel kind of right.
And there's almost like these sort of rainbow gradients happening.
Yeah.
Is this as you're writing, you're just grabbing different inks?
Changing different colors. Yeah. Jonathan had seen an artwork by, I can't remember who it was by, but it was a kind of textual artwork and he was very into it. So he's, I don't know, he always works like that. He'll be doing something and he'll say, you'll just get this flood of emails saying, like through the night saying, I've just seen this. Oh, what about this? Oh, we could try this. And it's, you do find yourself on this kind of like being bombarded on this sort of journey of exploration, I suppose, which can be challenging at times, I suppose.
Sure.
But in this instance, it was a good call. I've been struggling with this cover for 6 months. Wow. So, yeah, it'd been a long time. And it got to the point where... Actually, I think the publisher was... Well, I know the publisher had pulled me... They'd taken me off the job. They'd said, like, we're going to have to get someone else to do this because this is clearly just not working this time.
Because you were submitting covers and they were saying no.
I'd probably submitted by then 80 comps.
Wow.
So, yeah, it'd been on and on and on. And it was, yeah, painful. Actually, it wasn't going anywhere. And then I think another designer had a go. Jonathan didn't like that. And then said, actually, I've got this other idea about lettering. Maybe we could try something like that. And it happened that it worked. So, but, yeah, I did think this is the end of my relationship with the books of Jonathan Safran Foer.
Wow.
Fancy. Thankfully not.
Well, I mean, which is crazy to hear, considering how, you know, how sort of known these other covers are.
Well,
right?
Yeah. But that's one of the things, isn't it, about, well, for instance, that, you know, that cover, you would never know. If you looked at that, you would think, well, that probably didn't take very long. It probably took, you know, it probably took like a day or something. But actually that took, you know, best part of a year in the end to get right. So... It's funny the stories that go behind these visuals that you just think like, yeah, you probably just stuck some type on and that was it.
Well, that's, you know, that's the thing we underestimate constantly, right? Mm. Is the amount of iteration that has to happen before you find the easy idea, the simple idea.
Yeah, exactly. All of that work to come back to nothing.
Yeah. It's a mess, isn't it? Because here I am, you're 18 years into your career.
Yeah,
and you'd think that by that point you'd have this sort of spidey sense of exactly what to do.
Yeah, whereas in fact it goes the other way. I think you're so fearful of making a wrong move that you actually probably don't explore in the way that you did with the earlier books. I think you bring all that pressure, you know, to the blank page before you even started. I think, like, you're basically, all you can hear are the voices saying, you're finished, this is crap, you know, this is going to be a bad idea, you know, your career's over, etc. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
All of that comes with you, so it's annoying, really annoying.
You forget that sense of fragility doesn't really go away with experience.
Yeah.
I was watching a documentary, I think it was Sally Mann. Mm. The photographer, you know, that she did all the controversial photos of her children. And in the doc, you know, this is a doc that was made like maybe 10 years ago. She's like super well known, exhibited everywhere, and she's trying to prep for this new exhibition. And she puts it all together and she pitches it, and all the galleries reject her. And there's a scene of her just like breaking down in her house, and you go, holy Christ! You know, it's like someone who's gone this far. It is this well known, and you know, selling images for, you know, how much, still has that sense of like imposter syndrome that you expect to overcome that. But
when I was talking to someone here only like a couple of days ago, and I was just saying, you know, I still feel that I'm never sure I'm going to get another job. I'm never sure some more work's going to come in. You know, and it's always a worry. And she sort of looked at me like, said, like, but you've been doing this for like 20, you've been freelance for 20 years, you've worked for, you know, 25. Yeah. Is there not, surely now's the time to say, actually, you know, I'm going to get work and just sort of drop that, you know.
But I think there's something connected between that sense of infinite tenuousness and this lack of not confidence, but just kind of being aware that stuff disappears, stuff goes away, right?
Yeah.
And between that and interesting creative work, I mean, because it's, I think part of it is it's not allowing yourself to be complacent.
Yeah.
And I mean, at least I find for myself, like as soon as I feel I'm slipping into complacency, that's when I start doing shit work.
Yeah, me too.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think there is this kind of like built-in, maybe habit or system where you're like, okay, I'm never going to let myself get comfortable because I know that's when the work suffers.
Goes wrong. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Yeah.
Like Karl Lagerfeld, you know, he just passed away and I feel like he was obviously confident, but he never stopped doing a million things at once.
No.
You know, like doing six, you know, brands, entire catalogs at once or whatever he was doing. I loved his interviews.
Yeah.
And the sort of the insane work ethic he had. But I think that's connected, similarly connected. You know, it's a sense of, if I take my foot off the gas, it's all going to fall apart.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. I think there's also that link to age as well, isn't there? There's that feeling that almost that you've still got to prove yourself, that you've got it, that you're still relevant and that, you know, you can still do a good job. And then we've probably all seen designers or artists who've got older and started to do things that are slightly more dubious than you, and that have been slightly phoned in.
Yeah.
And I think there's that fear that, oh my God, am I going to be the one who does that? And the young people just say, what is he doing?
We never
want to work with this guy again. So,
well, when you're young, you're obsessed with proving that you can do anything.
Yeah.
And then when you get successful, you're obsessed with proving that you're not a wash up.
proving that you can do something. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the bargain we take with this kind of work, right? With this kind of creative work, is you never really get to relax. You're saying that, like, Jonathan's sort of involved with the cover process.
Yeah.
What about your other authors, like Zadie? Is she sending you things? Is she giving you a lot of feedback?
Zadie Smith is like the joy. She's just the best author to work for, and I don't know. I'm anxious about telling anyone that, because it's just like everyone will want to work with her, and maybe they won't give it to me. Her and her editor will just send me, right, she'll say, I've got this new book, Swing Time. It's set here. It involves these characters. And I don't know. I've got this feeling of like maybe we could do something deco with it. But I also want it to be modern. So you think like, oh, modern deco. Oh, I can do that. Yeah. And so suddenly, you know, you're off on this journey. Or she'll say, I don't know, for a recent one I've done, she'll send me like a load of images of old Philip Roth books. Mm-hmm. And you think, okay, I know, you know, she can speak the shorthand, I suppose, that a lot of authors can't. She can, like, a lot of the time my job is to kind of distill the words into some sort of one image, one unifying image. And she can just, I don't know, she can just do that. She can just speak that language, so she can tell you visually the flavour of her book. And so many authors can't. So I know it's such a joy, because she just says like, oh, I've been looking at these old Philip Roth books and I kind of really like the feel of that. It feels appropriate for my book of, you know, upcoming essays or stories. Mm-hmm. I can't remember. So we just do that, and then it gets emailed to her, and she says, "That's it, that's perfect." And you're just like, "Wow, you know,
I do know what I'm doing."
Yeah, exactly. Finally, So yeah, no, her covers will often come together very quickly, and she's so positive and so like willing to try different things. So yeah, and that I don't know whether it's in that instance she's got a brilliant editor as well, Simon at Penguin, who's fantastic. So I don't know, they always it's always like a breath of fresh air when I get a new Zadie Smith book, because I know it's not going to be arduous, you know. Right. It's she kind of gives you space, so okay, it's good.
Right. So speaking of Philip Roth, we got a Philip Roth over here.
Yeah.
And this is one you did.
Yes, I did like the whole backlist for Philip Roth, and then a couple of frontlist titles. Yeah, while back now, but yes.
And so it's Philip Roth, Nemesis, kids jumping off a pier.
Yeah, I think that photo was supplied. He'd either seen it or it was from the publisher, I think.
Mm.
I don't know. I never got direct contact with Philip Roth. It always just went straight through the publisher. And I don't know, I suppose designing the backlist was actually very hard. It wasn't straightforward, because I set up this very simple grid. I don't know if I've got any more here. I don't think I have, but it was a very simple grid, and it was just there was one photograph to be dropped in into the space. So it was mainly a picture research project. But Philip Roth wouldn't give advice as to what the images were he wanted. Mm. He would just say when he didn't like the images.
Mm.
So again, you would choose, I don't know, send three or four for each cover, and you just got back an email saying no. And then, that was it. And then you'd submit some more and you get no. And then you need some more, and you get no.
In a way, that's kind of nice.
Kind of, but right? His backlist is quite large. So right. After a while, it was, I don't know, again, I think the backlist must have taken probably 2 years to finish just because it was that process of...
And how do you bill on a project like that?
Well, this is the other joy of publishing. I don't know. You don't. You bill a set fee.
Yeah.
That's the trouble with publishing. You don't. You can't say, oh...
If we do 800 iterations, it's going to
exactly. Cost. Or you can't say, oh, it's taken me 6 months. Can I bill you for all the extra work? Yeah. No, it's generally like, you know.
Cover.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's another reason why Zadie Smith is so nice to work for.
It's a good.
Because you know that you're financially, it's kind of, time-wise, it's work.
Well, we got a Martin Amis set.
Yeah,
going on here
yeah.
with these are kind of some bold colors and
yeah
some,
that was
some
again
shapes.
That was for vintage in the States. I just wanted to break that down into like very bright sort of simple. We've used I think it's like a gill, a very sort of English feeling font, and I just wanted to use graphic shapes for those. Keep it simple. That's a pile of old junk.
Oh, nice. What's going on here? What's this? This is old maps.
Yep, some old maps. I mean, these are the boxes. Because I'm packing my studio, this is why we're going through these boxes, basically, because nothing was left out, so I thought we'd just go through some stuff. But I don't know. I keep piles and piles of junk, and they're just like old English maps. But at some point, for some job, will come in handy, I hope.
It's amazing, isn't it, when you look at... When you really look at these things and look at the amount of precision, and how we kind of take this for granted, right?
Oh, completely.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
well, especially if you think they were hand drawn, they're not. It's not, you know, it's not in Illustrator and lines redrawn when things don't work. It's engraved, isn't it? Basically.
And then colored and, but I mean, even just to get these measurements, never mind draw it out, you know, setting up trig points all over the country and, you know, sending people out to go measure and before satellites.
And if you think how important they were to people, you know, in terms of getting somewhere, where we kind of, you know, we just happen to
Google map it.
Exactly.
Yeah, part of my relationship with London, too, it's like on this trip, it's the first trip I've really used Google Maps in the city.
Right.
And I'm starting to star stuff. That starring in a city collecting stars, to me, is like my ownership or understanding of the city is kind of connected to that.
That's nice, isn't it? Yeah. In your own personal...
Yeah. But it does make... you know, moving through space pretty effortless. I always find it... We don't have to talk. So, yeah, I won't say
don't
which
say
one.
What it is, yeah.
I won't say
yeah, we'll ignore that.
Great. So how many times do you submit a cover and you're like, I actually am not proud of this, but... Because you're like, you're twisting stuff to match what they want, and you kind of get to a point where you're like, all right, we just have to...
We have to let it go. Yeah, I really try not to. I think when you start out in this job, you send like probably, I don't know, 8 to 10 ideas. And because you've sat and thought about 8 to 10 ideas, they're all quite sort of diluted. There's nothing that you're really particularly proud of.
Mm.
And I think I've really tried to not do that over the years. I've tried to hone it down to one really good idea and then two or three that are sort of just behind it. You kind of, you know, if they choose one of those, God forbid, you could probably make slightly better and be sort of fairly pleased with. But, you know, so some stuff also your judgment changes, doesn't it? Some of this stuff is getting on a bit now, and I look at it and I think oh, that is bad, you know.
Like without pointing anything out specifically, what
What the, movies are better? I'm not going to talk about these, I don't know, just something you just wish I'd like. I wish I'd given it a bit more time. Like, I can see one in the series that I think's good, but I can see some weak points where I was running out of time and I just had to let things go, I suppose.
What does that mean? What does that mean? Like, what's a weak point?
Like, I can see the idea. I don't want to talk about individual covers, but I can see the idea, but I know that it's not had enough time given to it. So it's, you know, in some instances I want to be crude,
yep.
But in some instances I've been crude where I think maybe I shouldn't have been. Yes. Okay. It's just a bit shit. The cover we're looking at is just a bit shit, but we're not going to talk about it because the publisher might be listening. So, yes.
Right.
I don't know. Sometimes you have ideas and they don't sort of come off as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing I've become really sensitive to is like watching a film or reading a book or a script or something like that, that you're like, okay, we're two iterations away from it being good.
Yeah.
Like all the bones are there. Everything is ready.
Yeah.
You just got to sit with it for two more iterations. You just got to do it.
Yeah.
You can't, like, and that means cutting and it means adding, but it's just not quite there.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think sometimes, you know, sometimes you let things go too soon. Here's the rest of those.
Oh, the Ginsberg.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. So
that gives you an idea of
that's interesting.
What we were trying to.
And this is all your lettering?
Yes. And it's funny because, I don't know, there was a point after Everything is Illuminated where a lot of people were saying, oh, can you do us your sort of hand-drawn thing? And I've got a friend from school who just said, like, oh, my God, he said, I keep going to bookshops and your crap handwriting is, like, everywhere. Why is this, you know, why do people want this rubbish?
Well, did HP make a font and then do an entire ad campaign around here? But it's funny. It's like, I mean, you lean into the. But this is really pretty. This is your handwriting too.
Yeah.
So this is very pretty.
Oh, thank you.
That's beautiful.
But with smudges because I had to mess it up.
Right.
Yeah.
No, but I think there is an art, and I think that's one of the problems. Is like people can look at, like, the Everything is Illuminated cover and go, oh yeah, my kid could do that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
yeah.
If your kid could do that, he'd be a book designer. She'd be a book designer.
Yeah, well, yeah, poor kid. Yeah.
But there is something about the messiness and proportions and, like, I don't, you know, God forbid you say wabi-sabi, but the wabi-sabiness of...
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Completely, yeah. I mean, I you wouldn't believe the amount of time that I've sort of spent deliberately forcing things just that bit further so they're slightly, you know, uglier.
Yeah.
Which is crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. But there's something about that. It's signaling nature and humanity and, I don't know, like a human touch. I think part of, too, maybe why these covers and this kind of, you know, hand-drawnness is, like, kind of, in the last 20 years, has been big. Mm. You know, in a way, it's a response to digital typesetting, right?
Yeah.
It's a response to, you know, InDesign and...
Yeah.
Quark and all that stuff.
To quote HP, it's trying to make it personal again.
Personal, there we go.
Yeah. I think it is. I think that was it. I think it was a direct response at the time to typesetting. I think it's like you can add personality. You can add, like, in someone's hand, literally someone's handwriting. You know, you can make it feel like, you know, it's designed by a human. So,
yeah.
Yeah. But then it's gone the other way. And now... those hand fonts are now been set, and McDonald's use them to sell burgers, and it's suddenly, like, it's not personal anymore. It's a set digital version of a human, which is very strange.
Yeah, it's just part of the cycle.
Yeah.
The cycle of this stuff, right? Like, if anything has any kind of commercial value, it gets commoditized and plastered everywhere.
Yeah.
Then we get sick of it, and we'll forget about it for... couple decades, and then we'll come back to it.
Yeah, till I'm an old man.
You can go back to do it.
Exactly.
So what do we got here? We got some...
Right, well, here we go. Talking about ugly, good, ugly, pretty. But yeah, there are. This is a set of Central European classics for Penguin. And for this, I don't know, I was saying before with that, the dolls, I like to set myself little briefs. So in this case, it's the idea of photography and illustration, like, interacting together. So these are very much, like, if you look at these are very much based on kind of Eastern European graphics. I think I've probably been looking at Matchbox labels, looking at them now, because they're quite similar to those sort of beautiful old Polish Matchbox labels.
Yeah.
But yeah, trying to get photography to interact with illustration in this sort of like 1950s way, I guess. And in this case, again, I've made an ugly font. I think I've got this... obsession with like making, so I hand drew this sort of clunky font, and then I've added sort of scripted bits of fonts as well. Just wanted them all to be sort of full of life, really. Yeah. I think my brief was, you know, these are quite cold, austere looking books. We want to make them accessible. I get that a lot. I think I get this accessible tag quite a lot. People say, oh, can you make them accessible? I also got one really nasty email from someone. I can't remember which book it was. I think it might have been the Chapek, The War with the Newts. Just saying, like, I think this is one of the worst covers for this book I've ever.
Really?
And you put me off reading it. So, yeah.
Well, that's the risk, right? Because this is, you're putting a face on something that...
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
People have already, you know, kind of imagined their own face for, or grown up with a different cover.
Yeah, and some people like want to. Yeah, you know, if this is serious literature, they want a serious cover. They don't want something that's kind of flippant. They want something that shows their intellect on their bookshelf.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Well, if you turn it sideways, it looks pretty serious.
Yeah. Come
on. That's fine, and they all go together. So you have 25 years of book design.
Yeah, that's a good one.
20 years of freelance.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is really interesting. So we got Albert Espinosa.
Yeah.
The Yellow World.
Yeah.
It's just, there's nothing on the cover except for a yellow.
Yeah, it's just a large yellow dot.
And how did you make that?
That is cut out of paper and then just slightly offset because I wanted it to look just handmade, I suppose.
Yeah.
This is a book. It's a self-help book. It's about a man's or boy's experience with cancer, basically. And they came to me and said, like, I don't know how we're going to do this. I don't know how we can make this something that someone would want to pick up in a bookshop. They said it's an incredibly inspiring story. It's like beautifully written, and you know, we want everyone to read it. We don't want people just, you know, necessarily who are looking for a book on cancer or, you know, a self-help book to pick it up. We want everyone to read it. So I know we talked about it and thought maybe if we took the title's quite an odd one anyway in itself. If we just took that yellow shape, the yellow world, and just made it a sort of big yellow planet and stuck it as a dot on the cover, then maybe in the bookshop you're then kind of faced with this strange object and just think, oh, I wonder what that is. And it's almost, you know, the very act of the fact you're picking it up and turning it over and reading the book, you'd kind of already got someone's interest, I think. So
yeah,
I mean, yeah, it seems to work.
You're 90% of the way there.
Yeah.
And where does the phrase come from?
Do you know what? I can't remember.
Hmm. But it was his. This was his title that he wanted. Yeah.
Yeah.
You see it. It intrigues you. You pick it up.
Yeah.
You open to the first page. And you know you have Gabriel Ciela was an engineer and a poet. I am an engineer and a scriptwriter. We're both left-handed. There's something about his poem autobiography that goes right through me. Brings a lump to my throat. And you're like, yeah, all right, yeah, I can hang with this guy.
Yeah.
I'm curious. I'm definitely curious. I've always wanted to talk about the yellow world, what I call my world, the world I live in. If you ever see a film I've made or read a script or notice a character I've written, you'll find a part of this yellow world. This is the world that makes me happy, the world I like living.
See?
Yeah, so you get pulled in.
Yeah,
that's
good.
All you need.
He's good.
But yeah, I mean, the problem is that if everyone makes their book covers like this, then it doesn't work anymore.
No.
Right.
You're always trying to look at the environment that you're going into and trying to think, well, all right, this here is like, if you say like a bookshop is like a crowd of faces, how am I going to make this person look interesting amongst that crowd of faces? Right. You know, how am I going to like not look like everyone else? And I think that's often my job, which has got harder with, you know, kind of online, because you're completely bombarded by all sorts of faces.
Well, it's been interesting to watch what like MCD and FSG are doing with their little animated covers.
Yeah.
You know, Rodrigo, he's killing it, right?
Oh, he's always been killing it. Like, I just think him and his team are amazing.
Yeah.
Constantly. Yeah.
Yeah. And, but I like, you know, over the last 10 years, especially, right, like with the digital stuff happening and Kindle kind of coming up and Amazon really taking over and winning, you know, in terms of market space, how do you have these inert things live in a digital, you know, sort of fluid space?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a whole book trailer movement, you know, about 10 years ago that was, everyone kind of goes, let's pretend that didn't happen.
Yeah.
Horrible,
well, it's just this thing, it's like everyone forgets, like, you know, it's fine to have the ideas, but publishing just has not got the money or the resources to back it up.
Yeah.
And it just looks, I mean, it's just like, you know, C movie, not even B movie. It's so badly done. You know?
Just a mess. But I said, you know, there was a few gems, few and far between.
Yeah.
Was it Super Sad True Love Story or something like that? Or
I don't remember that one.
I'm forgetting his name now.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
what's his name? The Russian guy.
Gary Steingart.
Yes.
Yeah. He's good. Well, they're funny, aren't they? I mean, that worked, didn't it? Because you had like a comedian, which was it, Ben Stiller's in that, isn't he? In his latest trailer. I don't know if you've seen that.
James Franco is in one of the old ones, playing his husband.
Wow.
And they kiss.
Amazing.
And then, yeah, anyway, I think that's the only way to do it is if they're funny.
Yeah.
But, you know, unless you've got access to A-level Hollywood stars, you probably shouldn't be making a book trailer. But the thing that FSG and MCD have been to take covers like this and add just the smallest amount of animation.
Yeah.
And so when you're scrolling through Instagram and they start moving, it's just enough.
Yeah, it has to be done well, though.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen so many people trying to replicate that and do it in such a crass way that you just think, oh, just...
What about you? I mean, like 25 years, you've kind of gone from really the height, late 90s, early 2000s, peak of publishing, right?
Yeah.
Where it's just money everywhere.
Yeah.
To work, everything's going to fall apart.
Yeah.
Amazon's going to destroy everything.
Yeah.
Everything has to be an app.
Yeah.
You know, nine years ago, everyone was trying to make apps and figure out if they should have app teams.
Oh, people were told they were going to lose their jobs, so they should start thinking about an alternative career.
Yeah. You mean book designers?
Yeah.
And how was it?
Still here.
Did you feel any of that? Was there ever like a crunch period where you're like, shit, man, maybe this is going to go away?
I think everyone had talked about it. But I mean, I have been doing this for a long time. So I've been around since like the last recession. So where publishing has this weird thing whereby... I don't know. It talks a good game. It says, like, actually, what we should now do is reduce the amount we publish and make sure it's only really good stuff. But they don't do that. They do the opposite. Especially in a recession, they actually, you know, it becomes more and more like a horse race. They just, like, throw more and more horses into the race. You know, they're desperate to find, you know, another success. So they'll just keep backing more and more horses in the hope they'll find one of them is going to win the race.
Well, I mean, yeah, the reality is like knowing what's going to work in the market is not a guarantee. There's no formula.
It's never been predictable.
If it was, it would be the easiest business in the world.
Exactly.
Right?
And so consequently, there's more books, there's more need for covers, there's more need for people who've designed covers for books that have worked at one stage or another, because they think, well, you know,
do that again.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the semblance of a formula.
Yeah.
Is there. So yeah. Let's, yeah, no.
So no, I haven't as yet, you know. And also, I think the technology never delivered on the promise, or hasn't yet, in terms of e-readers.
Right.
I think it just, you know, I don't know, it's just so static and so, I don't know, ugly. Do you know, it's never sort of felt that it's followed through. So, I mean, lots of people read on their phones, I get that, but it's still, it doesn't feel like a well-designed experience. It feels like you're still, you know, like email, you're just reading something that's just information. It doesn't feel like it's like a book, I suppose.
Well, it's also the wrong context.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, to engage with this stuff, you can't dip in and out.
No.
For the most part.
Yeah.
I can't, at least. And so, I don't even read books on my phone.
No.
I don't try to. It's just impossible. There's too much, you know, burbling under the surface, calling for your attention to really stay engaged. And so I have a Kindle for when I'm traveling, which is great, right? To be able to carry that, a couple books around without having it weigh a lot.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's no joy in the machine.
No.
At all. E-ink, I think there's potential for joy in e-ink as a technology.
Yeah.
The e-ink screens can be beautiful.
Yeah.
It's just Amazon has not cared about beauty in its, you know, 25-year history.
No, it doesn't seem to. It just, it's just been about that information. I don't know, there's also this thing about, I was sitting there the other night and I had to read a book on an e-reader. This is the ironic thing. A lot of my manuscripts are provided digitally, so I have to read the book digitally to then design it in paper, which is, I don't know, strange. But anyway, I was sat there the other night, and you're sat there with this sort of blue light screen, I don't know, just before you go to bed, thinking, this is not good. You know, I've been on these screens all day. Yeah. The last thing I want to do is sit here now with this screen. I want something softer. I want some paper. I want some, you know, you want something different, don't you? And it's just not doing it for me, I think. You want a different experience away from your email and from your a phone and from, you know, from messages.
Well, I mean, I it's like the whole thing of even just having your phone on the table at like dinner or having your phone on the table when you're trying to work on something, quote unquote, studies have shown that, you know, your attention or your ability to focus it drops by like 20%.
Really?
Just having the device in your field of vision. And yeah, I mean, if you're trying to engage with, you know, a long form piece of text, and you're touching the thing that is designed now to take away your attention, to pull you in different directions. Yeah, it's not going to feel good.
No.
It's not going to work. I mean, the one saving grace of like the Amazon Kindle stuff, the e-ink readers, is that they are so badly kind of designed.
Yeah,
you're disincentivized to move around in it. So like even just going like, all right, go back to the library. Like, let me try to find that book. Like, who knows where it is? The refresh is so slow. Like, you don't really want to move anywhere except for either the next or previous page.
No.
So that's kind of
a
benefit.
Do you have like ugly adverts on yours as well? Like,
I paid to get rid of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't need to do that.
Okay. When I buy a Kindle, it costs me like $600.
Really?
Because I turn off all the ads and I do the unlimited 3G. You know, worldwide 3G, which I think is like one of the most innovative things they've added to it.
Right.
Where you can just be anywhere and it's...
I didn't even know you could do that.
That's the magic. Should we transition over to your workspace?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So we're in the workspace.
Yeah. So I'm trying to find some...
And has this, since you moved into this building 8 years ago, has this been your space the whole time?
Yeah. You go, look, this is that Hewlett-Packard font that I winded up doing. That's the start of it.
Amazing.
So that means that the rest of it is, rest of it's in here somewhere.
It's funny how crude everything looks here.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it is. You know, it gets drawn and scanned and then tightened up as we go.
And so,
but most of it starts with ink.
It's a combination of you've got sort of normal poster paper, it looks like, and then you've got, here we go. Yeah. So
that's an interesting one. That's a because this a saffron foil book.
The title got switched.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So.
So this is I'm okay, it says, and then it got switched to
extremely loud and incredibly close.
So easy transition for you.
Yeah. So unfortunately, that design kind of then proved totally defunct. Yeah, there was nothing I could do with it at all. So.
It's beautiful though, and you, why have I seen this before? Is it because you showed it?
I had it on I must have done it in a tour.
Yeah. Oh, this one you have wrapped up, so you have the Everything is Illuminated.
Yeah, I did. I wrapped that one up because someone came in the other day and said, like, should you not be protecting that? Is that probably not worth, like, you know, I think people know it, so you should probably look after it a bit more.
This is the original.
Yeah, this is the first thing that I did. Yeah. So basically this is, the original that I've just scanned in and pulled around a bit and sharpened up a bit.
And so it looks like you, this is, can I touch it?
Yeah, of course.
So this is sort of like a textured, what is this, like a watercolor paper?
Yeah, watercolor paper.
Yeah. And then it's got some margin, so you have your kind of like a...
Yeah, these are my cover margins.
Cover margins, right.
So here's the spine, here's the front, the crop of the front.
Yep. Yeah. Well, I feel like this could probably be sold to someone for a couple bucks.
$3 maybe.
Well, it's just interesting to see.
How crude it
is. Yeah. Well, you said this is the first one you did?
Well, no, that's pretty much it. I did that, and then I've scanned it, and I've just kind of, I don't know,
cleaned it up a bit.
But, I mean, what did you do before? How many iterations did you do before you got to this?
Visuals.
Yeah.
Well, I'd done some really bad visuals for that job, actually, some really sort of terrible things. Kind of like real clichés. I don't know, book design is like, or a lot of book design is cliche anyway, but there was a lot of kind of pebbles on beaches, hands holding, I can't remember, like maybe a bird's nest or a stone or something ridiculously bad. So then I had this conversation with my friend who's art director at Penguin, John Hamilton, who sadly passed away last week. But terrible. Anyway, so I had a conversation with him and he said, oh, well, why don't you try something text-based? Why don't you do something kind of like typographic? And at the time, like my idea of typographic covers was this kind of very set, very staid sort of lettering. And I was thinking, well, that just doesn't fit this book. Why is he saying typographic? And then I don't know, I'd been looking at this book of old church signs that I happen to have. And I thought, oh, this maybe something like this will work because this is, you know, I can see the pastor who's kind of made these signs. You can see his handwriting. You can see his personality in those signs. And I thought, oh, I could do something similar. I could just show the character of the anarchic narrator of this book, like through the font. So, yeah, I just started trying to channel that spirit, I suppose, into the cover and paint like I'd imagine he would paint if he had a paintbrush kind of thing. So,
right.
And that's how we ended up with this.
But church, so it's interesting, church signs, handmade church signs is kind of the seed.
Yeah, complete. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, walking around London, I mean, the thing that I'm sort of delighted by is just how messy all the street writing is. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
It's incredible, all the look right, look left stuff, and then the arrows and the lines.
Really
it's
crude.
Super messy.
Yeah, it is.
But like messy in this kind of organized, like it's consistently messy.
Yeah.
Right? Like the edges are so rough.
It's crudely done. Yeah.
But I mean, this is a city of hand lettered roads.
But I suppose that's interesting because when I was in Japan, I noticed how sharp and how smooth they are, and they're lined out, aren't they? You know, you can see the chalk on the.
Yeah.
I saw some new stuff that had been done in Tokyo,
yeah.
and you can see the deliberate lines. Like here, they will just take a white line marker and just basically just slap the type on the road.
Yeah.
In a rough idea of how it should look, but.
But I think it's kind of, there's something really endearing about it. Like I'm walking around the city and I'm just like, I'm smiling at all the road marks.
Nice.
Just because it feels like a little bit like a miracle or something today, like that a city of this size.
Yeah.
Like if we were in some other random city that was not like one of the biggest most wealthy cities in the world, and you'd see that, you go, okay, yeah, right, you just kind of hand paint it. But we're in London.
It's true. I don't always think that. I always think I always imagine, what does like the tube look like to everyone else from around the world, everyone else who's gone on, who's taken that idea and thought, actually, we'll build a proper subway system that's wide and it's big and it fits lots of people.
It's
that we're still running this sort of model railway as in the biggest city in the world,
Well, I mean, that's first mover disadvantage, right?
Yeah.
So, like, when you,
But still, are we still doing that? We didn't think about rebuilding it or redoing it. It's still, heritage.
Yeah, it's, it's endearing if you don't have to commute.
Yeah. Harry Potter world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, we got over here this Stephen King sign.
Oh, okay.
What's going on with this?
That was for a fiction article in the New Yorker. Basically, they have this fiction section in the New Yorker where once a month they publish a short story by a writer, and they ask book designers or illustrators to illustrate it. And I was lucky enough to get Stephen King, so that was just the original type that I then went on to sort of put onto a tree, I think, and then got some sort of bullet hole in it or something like that.
You put it onto a tree.
I use the power of Photoshop to impose it onto some wood.
Who is this silhouette we have?
I can't remember who that is. It's just something that I've done or did for a book cover, and I thought, actually, that's not bad, so I kept it. It's like, a lot of my stuff, I think, that's pretty shit, but this is all right. Can I show you these paintings while we're like them? Just because I feel like you need to see. Yeah, so that's like the original. So you get the idea of.
So talk me through how you did this. Did you draw any guides for this, or did you?
I've drawn like individual, like you can see pencil lines,
mm-hmm.
and then I've just just then started from left and carried on, and then because you're reducing it down, it all kind of. It's bonkers, isn't it? I mean, that's, that's the things you do for a book jacket, What's that got to do with a book jacket? I think there's no other kind of, if I was in advertising, then someone would have done that, for me. I wouldn't have to, but because of the way book design is, you kind of get to do anything yourself. I'll take photos, I'll draw stuff, I'll make stuff.
Have you exhibited this stuff before?
No, not at all.
Why? That's crazy. That seems like a pretty obvious thing to do.
That's the Polish.
The Polish one? Great.
I don't speak Polish, so this is all,
Just copying, hoping you get it right.
Just hoping I get it right.
And where do these boards come from? They're just kind of laying around.
I got a timber merchant to just cut some boards for me, to roughly the size that I thought these were going to be.
Yeah, it's funny. Well, and I guess I can see the proportions here. Like, I mean, it almost looks like the big long 16x9 boards.
Mm.
Those look like if you open up a book. Ah, look at that.
Okay. So that's an original test. I think a little one. And then we've just gone from there.
But I mean, these boards, it's like, if you open up a book jacket and kind of spread it out,
exactly.
it would be this proportion, right?
So it goes right around, yeah. But then that was kind of one avenue for this cover. I mean, there's There's a pile of stuff in here which is like where we were at before, which is fingerprints. So I had this idea of every cover would be like literally kind of fingerprinted.
So, well, you've done one with your hand, you might as well give the world your fingerprints too.
Exactly. Yeah, but we did hundreds of these as well. Like, this is hundreds. This is like, by the end of making these, I've got like, you know, bleeding thumbs. There is like, if you look, like the prints are so closed up, it's actually starting to look like just like a shape. You can't even see my fingerprint anymore.
So to describe this, it's like a field of fingerprints, and then you've taped the typography.
Yeah.
And then you've pulled the tape off.
Yeah.
I see. Yeah.
So we lay down the tape, mask off an area, and then thumbprint over the top. And then after about this one was too Christmassy.
Yeah.
Apparently. Yeah. This one was, you know, not bright enough. So after a while, I got to the stage where my thumbs were all broken and there was no print coming out. And someone in the studio said, "Oh, have you never thought of just getting a rubber stamp?" And then there was that moment of like, "Oh, you idiot." And she said, "Actually, I think I've got one." So she like lent me a rubber stamp with some thumbprint. And yeah. But anyway, we did hundreds of these. As I said, this cover went on for a year.
It didn't work.
No, there was something just not quite right about it.
But what's interesting is, I mean, you do get the final cover, you see some of the DNA of that in these.
Yeah, you do.
Right. Definitely, so like the just the feel of this type.
Yeah.
You know, definitely this carried through.
Yeah, the eye, but in particular, yeah, that eye.
But and then also just the layers, right? Because I mean, you ended up with, instead of thumbprints, this text behind it.
Yeah, it's true.
And well, in the coloring too. I mean, there's definitely some
synchronicity
between that as well, right?
Yeah, no, it's true.
But it's funny how, like, the jump from this to that was across a chasm of despair.
Like, oh, yeah. Well, I mean, this was my...
Assuming you were done.
This was the end. This was when I got sacked.
Okay.
Like, they basically said, like, you know, we're going to get someone else to have a go. Right. So this was, the end of my career as far as I was concerned.
Wow.
Yeah, and then suddenly we just... I mean, that one... I was going to say that one was relatively quick. The idea was relatively quick to be approved, but the actual making of it was another 3 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what else is going on here? We got sketchbooks down here.
Oh, I mean, do you want to see? Actually,
yeah.
Let me show you one more thing.
Okay.
This is like, because I'm moving, all this artwork is like resurfacing, so...
Ah, right. Yeah. Infinite Jest, yeah.
Yeah, so this
I was wondering how you made this.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
So, yeah, this is like the artwork made from, like, tabs.
Right. I thought these were... I'd never looked closely at the cover, I guess.
Right.
And so I thought they were Post-its.
Yeah, they're slightly smaller. They're, like, little
tabs.
Yeah.
Well, and I was thinking if they were Post-its, like, Christ, that would have been
massive.
A big... Yeah.
Ah,
look at that. And what was the... talk us through getting to this.
God, right. Well, so this was like the anniversary edition of Infinite Jest.
Which anniversary? 10?
I think it's 20.
So he was gone by then.
Yeah. So this... Oh, no, this is... Yeah, this only came out last year before.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. America commissioned me to do... the anniversary edition. I'd seen this artwork by Corrie Baldorf, who basically she'd gone through Infinite Jest and using these sort of tabs, taken out themes like and colours and marked them in these kind of Post-it tabs. And I just thought this was like an amazing object. And I was thinking like, wow, you know, and obviously I kept that in the back of my mind for some reason.
Yeah.
And when it came to this, I thought, oh, what am I going to do? I don't quite understand. I mean, I tried to read the book and I spent my whole time flicking backwards and forwards to the footnotes.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, this whole this whole experience is about the footnotes in a way. It is that kind of, there's a backwards and forwards, you know. And I thought, well, why don't I just use the tabs that she's done and make the whole text, the whole cover out of that. And also, I love the John Gall's original cover, which is that kind of the blue clouds and the bold yellow type. I thought, well, why don't we just take that and use that as our basis, but make it out of these tabs and have it kind of fading and sort of breaking up. So, because it feels like, you know, without those footnotes, the novel, I don't know, is half a novel almost, isn't it? So, it kind of breaks up as you flow through.
But that's interesting. I mean, like, you're talking again about, like, you know, John Gall setting the branding of the book running with that.
Yeah.
Because why break that? Because, I mean, that really is, like, it's so
in my head, that's
etched. Yeah. Yeah.
And this was an anniversary, and I wanted to pay tribute to that, I guess.
Yeah.
But then what happened is in America, for whatever reason, I don't know, they decided not to run with it. They decided to open it up to like a public competition, which was a strange decision, I felt, but I could understand it. I think it was maybe the estate wanted to do this, but it meant that having spent, you know, however long making this thing, the whole project was dead. And I was just, you know, completely devastated that I'd spent all this time doing this thing. So I thought about it and I thought, well, what am I, you know, this is no use. So I just rang up a friend who works at the UK publisher and said, like, don't suppose, you know, you're doing an anniversary edition. And they said, oh, we're waiting to see what America does. And I said, well, just to let you know that I have done a cover for it and it's been rejected. So I'm really pleased with it. So do you want to see it? And I sent it to them and they said, oh, well, let's do it. So we did it in the UK in the end.
Wow.
Which was great. But I'm still saddened that it didn't make it to the US.
But even though it didn't, like, this sort of tabbed cover, to me, it's like, it's etched into my mind as Infinite Jest now.
Oh, good.
Like, there's something, and like, maybe that's just having seen copies of it online or something.
Yeah.
But it, Instagram. I don't know. I think it won in the end. But I mean, what a disheartening story of, like, coming up with a killer, like, perfect cover. And then even, at your stage in your career with all this work, you know, they still kind of kick it to the curb.
Oh, it still happens all the time. It's
pretty depressing.
You know, marketing departments, sales departments, they've all got a strong idea of what they want. And if you don't fit it, then, they'll junk it. So also, it's a mad way of working, isn't it? Like, well, I tend to do is, like, do the final thing often and then say, here you go, do you like it? And if they say no, then that's it, you know, rather than say, I'm thinking of doing this thing with post-it notes, here's a little sketch, you know. Often I think, oh no, I'll do the whole thing, and then they can see it or really understand it. So which is nuts, really. But, what have we got? I don't know, it's difficult, isn't it?
So you just picked up, this is a cassette case.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is a book by Elaine Castillo, which is, it's the story of a Filipino girl in America. And also it's set in the 80s. So I just had this idea of, I didn't have this idea. That's not true, is it? Let's think about the text. The text in the book, basically, her whole life is her link to home are these old 80s cassettes that she's brought from the Philippines with her to America. So she'll play them in the car when she travels. So I don't know. These cassettes seem very important to me. So I thought, well, let's run with that. Let's, like, make a little cassette. I found out the price of a Filipino cassette in the 1980s. I've kind of made a little price sticker, and I've tried to lend it as much sort of authenticity as I can. Well, you were talking about Wabi Sabi earlier, and I would say, like, idiot. I would say, like, this whole cover, like, I realised there was something not working about it. There was something that was too static. It was feeling, like, not believable. It wasn't quite real. And then, because I cut the cover slightly short, I had to jam. Actually, I cut it slightly long, I think. It doesn't quite fit the box, so I had to jam it in.
Oh.
And actually, I suddenly realised that this crease...
Oh, right.
Suddenly, it became like one of those... Like those fake tapes, those fake cassettes you used to buy on Marcus, like back...
Right.
You know, back when you bought bootlegs.
Sure.
And I suddenly thought, well, that's it. Suddenly this is like, it's real again. It's like, it's worked. So, I don't know, that is, I don't know, it goes back to that personal thing again, I think. Just sort of lending something, some authenticity. I think quite often, like what I do is a bit like acting. You're trying to make it believable. You're trying to make your, it's a bit like you create props and you're trying to make them tie up with the world that's inside the book. So I think this felt like a prop.
Mm.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah, not totally. Really. No, but I mean, like, it also speaks to the insanity of this work.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like there is no method.
Yeah.
The fact that just by cutting the paper a little wrong, shoving it in there, and then having it not fit was the missing piece.
But there's also like layers of like, I mean, stupidity, in that I've kind of moved the inks so that the type doesn't quite line up. So it is, you know, I've gone to that level of like, I want it to look badly printed inside the case, and I've put these kind of bad screens. I want it to look originally bad, which is crazy, isn't it, when you think about it. Yeah.
Well, and especially considering that, like, no one's gonna intellectually grasp any of that.
No.
Right. It's all gonna be like subconscious and
yeah.
You know, you're gonna just feel it and there'll be three people who kind of scrutinize the cover and go, oh, this is interesting. I wonder where he found that cassette or
And two of them are probably me and the author. That's it. So that leaves one.
And the third
one. That leaves one one lunatic. Yeah. Oh, that's made me sad.
No. But I mean, this is the heart of craft, isn't it? It's like doing stuff that people, you know, don't pick up on. But I mean, that's...
I suppose that's it as well. And you're always going to look at this stuff as well. And you want to make sure that you've made it as to the best of your ability. Not your ability, but you've ticked all the boxes that make you happy with that being an object, don't you? So often you were talking about those covers that I don't like in that box that I don't want to show.
Sure.
And the reason is that I know there are two or three little details on them that I would do differently now that would improve them and would mean that I could look at them and think, ah, at least, you know, that is the complete vision that I had when I started that cover, rather than... Ugh, what the hell is that bit? It's so bad. Why didn't I just spend a little bit more time getting that right? So,
Well, I mean, you know, like in this America's Not the Heart cassette, for example, like, you know, even if people don't recognize the insanity of this wabi-sabi replication of whatever a cassette was, you know, 30 years ago, they're still delighted by it, right? So that's the win.
You know. I think that is the challenge as well. You don't want them to notice the bits. You want them just to think, oh, look, it's a cassette. You don't want them to think, oh, it's a mock-up of a cassette that's been, you know. I don't know, as I said, it's that level of authenticity you want. You want people to believe that it is exactly what it is.
Well, you don't want it to fall into the uncanny valley of anything.
Yes.
Where people start to go, oh, well, that doesn't look quite right.
It's
pastiche.
It's a hammy pastiche.
Yeah.
Like a cassette.
So what's happening with the shoe thing?
The shoe thing. Well, we used to have like a... So it should have all gone in the bin. It's like a paper shoe. I tell you what that is. It's because we used to have a German woman in the studio, and she said that there was a tradition whereby on... I can't remember if it was Christmas Eve or the week leading up to Christmas, whereby children would put their shoes out and they would be filled with money. They'd be filled with spare change. I don't know if you've ever heard that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I didn't have a shoe like lying around the studio, so I thought, oh, well, I'm just going to make a paper shoe. And I spent like an afternoon making this paper shoe and actually had like so much fun doing it that I've kept it. It's completely fallen apart. It's still full of money. Yeah, I should have thrown it away years ago, but I don't know. There's something about the fact that probably something more about how I felt when I made it that means I've kept it. I think because I enjoyed making it and there was a freedom in making it that sometimes I don't get in making work, that I think I kept it as a reminder of that time.
The olden days of shoemaking.
Exactly. Back in the, yeah.
And then you got the tree of the code tree.
Yeah, I've got one of the original sheets, I've got some other ones, but that was an original printer's sheet where they've cut the holes in, basically, and I just keep it up there. It was a nice object.
So. Yeah, no, they are. I have a bunch of those from books I've done.
Oh, right.
Yeah. As part of the process of selling some of the books, I was giving those away. I was shipping those off to people, as like a little thank you. Because it is, it's weird to get that, and then you look at all the registration marks and just this kind of this thing from which the book is made and folded, and something kind of delightful about seeing it deconstructed and out of order, right?
Yeah, exactly. I also think, that book is such a structural thing that it's kind of, it's like a weird sculpture almost.
And what do we got? So lots of paintbrushes,
lots of
pencils, lots of, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, this is because I'm cleaning out as well. It's not always as bad as this.
You got some
deodorant? It's quite bad, isn't it?
Is that deodorant?
Yeah, that's deodorant, yeah. Always, yeah. I knew you were coming, so I wanted to,
And then your desk is just chaos here, like in terms of the paint.
Yeah, my desk is like covering me. I've got this.
It's a huge desk.
Yeah, I should have like a separate workspace for like doing ink stuff and doing. Well, I have got a separate desk for doing ink stuff and doing computer stuff, but I get into this sort of frenzy whereby I'm wanting to get. Yeah, I'm wanting to get the work scanned in really quickly, and I get annoyed by the distance from table to table, so I just end up like inking in front of my computer, and because my hands are covered in ink, I end up then putting my hands on the keyboard and like certain keys don't work, so it's the whole thing's become quite an organic process.
And this is your scanner?
Yeah.
And what way can we see the glass on that? Is the scanner also just covered in ink?
Do you know, it's not, I mean, that is,
that's interesting,
but the glass is pretty, I try and keep my glass clean.
Yeah,
I'm not doing too well. But yeah,
that's funny. It's such a tiny little thing.
Yeah, it's pathetic.
But yeah. I didn't mean that.
No, it is. It's rubbish. But I tell you, the best thing about it is I can take it anywhere. I can carry it. You know, if I'm going abroad, I can stick it in the case or whatever. So,
well, that's what's crazy is like, this is, I remember, 15 years ago, the scanners that you had to use, these big, giant, horrible things that were slow and took forever.
Yeah.
That's nuts. And that costs like, $300 or something, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's,
we got notebooks, lots of notebooks. How important or like how much notebooking goes on before?
Well, this is a fascinating thing. Okay. I'm obsessed with notebooks. And I've got this thing about buying a new notebook when I'm starting a job or I'm traveling.
Okay.
So I'll buy a new notebook.
And then only use like.
And it'll be like, here we go. This is it. This is going to be, this is the new me. This is the new, I'm going to, yeah. I use like, probably one page, two page, and then I file it and I buy another one.
I do, I think this is pretty common.
But I also like, wherever I go, I'll buy like,
Japan ones.
Yeah, it's four pages, I think, probably. Probably like, yeah.
So,
I think this is.
Wait, what's going on in here?
Oh, no, that was a cover. So, like, I did actually think about a cover, yeah. So, yeah, that's not bad. But, yeah, most of them, I think, like, oh, that one's blank. But yeah, I know I've got piles and piles and piles. Some of them I did actually try.
To go all the way through?
Yeah, some of them. But most of them, nah. Little doodles.
It's kind of amazing. They're all different.
Yeah.
Every single one is different.
Yeah.
There's no consistency.
Nah.
You didn't find one you liked and stuck with it.
Nope. No. And like, I don't know. No, it's just never worked. It's always been, I've tried and tried and tried because I thought, oh, wouldn't it be great to be one of those designers who has like, his sketchbooks, and he just buys those over and over again, like uniform one.
And you have this, and you have your shelves just covered in like a lifetime of sketching, perfectly chronological.
Covers, like broken down.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, some of them have got like.
Oh, paper cutouts.
Things, you know, it's in there somewhere. But there's a lot of crap.
Well, it's kind of it's heartening to see this because I mean, when I was doing cover design a long time ago.
Yeah.
I was really into inking stuff. I mean, I don't even remember. It may have been influenced by your work at the time. I didn't go to school for design.
Right.
So I took one. I was in the fine arts program, but my focus was photography.
Yeah.
And I took one typography class and design class.
Yeah.
With this incredible teacher, Sharka Highland.
Right.
She was over in, this is at Penn.
Wow.
She's still there. Yeah. And really fantastic. You know, it's like one of those, like, you have one teacher that really kind of knocks your socks off. Yeah. And you keep going with it. Yeah, totally. And so she set me off on this, like, path of doing book design.
Yeah.
And it must have been, because that would have been 2003.
Right.
And I read Everything's Illuminated for sure that year.
That is around then, yeah.
And I bet there's a synchronicity. And so my apartment in Tokyo, when I was working on my first book designs there, I had brushes like this.
Right.
A complete mess.
Yeah.
Everything was inked. 50 different notebooks, you know, with like these kind of rough, you know, inkings and handwriting and, you know, trying to, and all this kind of, this tracing paper and,
But then you, look at you, you moved on, you grew up, you got rid of it.
I just wasn't good.
Whereas like me, stupidly, I'm still like, can't get out of it.
You were good. I was like, I'm not so great at this. But also I think this is something that I think having an apprenticeship, is extremely valuable because I had never worked in a publishing house, I had never worked with a real designer. Mm. And so I didn't understand how many iterations people went through.
Yeah.
Like that, and I think a lot of people fall into this trap where they think stuff just pops out perfectly.
Yeah.
And it's like, if you can't knock it out perfectly on sketch one, then give up, you suck.
Yeah.
And I think there was definitely an element of that I was feeling. And I was like, fuck, I'm just not good enough for this.
Yeah.
I'm not good enough, so let me move on. Whereas I think if I had apprenticed properly or gone to a publishing house, I would have seen, oh shit, they do 40 iterations before they get to the final cover. It's like, okay, that's...
And also, like, a lot of those designers fail. You know, a lot of those, you know, you can get Rodrigo in, you can get Admin or something, and we can have a go, but we can fail, you know, and they can say, actually, we're not going to use that.
Yeah.
It's not good enough,
yeah.
You know.
So for me... I was like, you know, I was like, I had the inklings of a direction, but I had done like insane, like for the Art Space Tokyo cover, I bought these really expensive digital maps of Tokyo, and then I would print them out, and then I would take these giant tracing papers, and I would get all this ink, and I would do these hand inkings, and the way addresses work in Tokyo is like, sort of basically, sections are broken down into smaller sections into the houses. And each house is given a number, and each section is given a number. And so I went through and I hand kind of like dotted all the numbers on these maps. This was like weeks of work of like doing this like insane. And then that cover, it's one of my favorite covers, but it's like you don't know you're going to get to a good place until it's all kind of put together. It's kind of interesting to see
thing. All of that time, all of that effort, all of that care, and it's distilled into something that a lot of people just say, oh, it's a map of Tokyo with some scribbles on it. You know what I mean? It's crazy, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and like we were saying earlier, like, you don't have a formula that you can depend on.
No.
You don't know if it's going to work.
No. But I do think that's been a conscious thing as well. Do you know what? There was a definite stage, I think, or there have been two or three stages in my career where it's been, I just call it a career. That's a weird thing. Anyway, whereby I'll have done a cover and someone will come along and say, oh, can you do another one of those? And I'll do it. And then someone else will come along. And suddenly I'll be thinking, all right, everyone, you know, if I'm not careful at this stage, I'm just going to be that guy, the guy who does the hand letter thing.
And so how do you subvert that? Like, how do you keep that from happening?
I think you remember, like, what you're doing. You sort of go back to the text. Like, every book is individual. So, you know, every novel is individual. So why would you make them all look the same? This doesn't make any sense. So that's the thing. Just go back to the book and think, like, well, I don't want this to look like that one because it's not like that one. So I need to make it different. So I think that's how. I think I just keep going back to the text and remembering that, you know, I've got to do my job to try and translate that author into their words into an image. So, and not just think, make it my image, make it their image.
Yeah. Well, thanks, man. Thanks for taking time.
No problem. It's been great.
Yeah, it was fun.
Thank you.
Cool. All right. That's pretty good.
Is that it?
It's enough, yeah. Is that it? We talked for like 6 hours.
I know. That was good. I enjoyed that.
Hey, woo, ha, whoop. You still there? That was a really, really long one. I know. Super long. Super crazy long for us. Anyway, not maybe for some other podcasts that are allergic to editing, but we're not going to name them. Anyway, wasn't I right? I mean, John is just good people. He's just a good dude you want to spend time with, you want to hang out with, and I am eternally grateful for his time that he gave to me and us, and opening up about, you know, how it feels to be a book designer today. You know, all the fears and everything else included. On Margins is made possible by the support via membership of listeners like you to the Explorers Club on craigmaude.com. So if you enjoyed today's episode and want to vote with your wallet, which is a, by the way, of all the things you can vote with, a pretty freaking good way of voting. You want to vote with your wallet and say, hey, Craig, more of that, man. More of that, please. Then head to craigmaude.com/membership and consider joining the Explorers Club. It means a lot to me. If you're not able to support via membership, then just consider leaving a review for the podcast on iTunes, because that helps my fragile ego feel like I am not just speaking into the void as death approaches. Aside from membership, today's episode is also sponsored by Bear Bells. I went on a 6-week walk across Japan in April and May, and all the bears were waking up from their slumber. Do you know what a bear is when it wakes up? It is hungry. And do you know what bears eat? Mainly humans. Yeah, that's right, mainly humans. And you know what? I didn't get eaten. How, Craig, did you avoid death by bear? A so very common way to end the gift of consciousness and self-aware life. And it was because of my trusty little bear bell. I walked, it tinkled, and the bears, upon hearing the gentle tinkle of my bell, ran away, because nothing is more frightening to a bear than a tinkle. So thank you, Bear Bells, for existing in the world and allowing me and other hikers to continue existing too.